Hi, I'm Josephine Ensign, author of Skid Road, On the Frontier of Health and Homelessness in an American City, and Way Home, Journeys Through Homelessness. For the past 40 years, I've worked as a nurse practitioner providing primary care to people experiencing poverty and homelessness. I have the lived experience of homelessness as a young adult. I live and work in Seattle, a city with our nation's third highest number of people experiencing homelessness. Only New York City and Los Angeles have higher numbers. The Skid Road podcast aims to amplify a diversity of voices about homelessness in the Seattle area. Beginning in 2015, when a state of emergency was declared for homelessness in our city and county, I've done a series of oral history interviews with local people living and working at the intersection of health and homelessness. Public health nurses, emergency department physicians, politicians, heads of nonprofit agencies, activists, and frontline staff. People who have not only endured homelessness, but who are now housed and are working on creative solutions to homelessness. I've learned a lot from my conversations with all of these people, and I want to share their insights with you. On a semi-weekly basis, I'll post a new podcast episode featuring these conversations, interspersed with some of my own reflections. Learn more about this project through my website at josephineensign.com. Please subscribe to this podcast and share it with others. Thanks for listening. Okay, so this is Josephine Ensign, and I'm here with Nancy Amade as the interviewee today for the Skid Road Project, and it's Tuesday, June 16th, 2015. And the purpose of the Skid Road Project, again, Nancy, is to increase an understanding of the complexity of charity healthcare in King County, Washington. And so I'm going to open up with just some questions, and this is you. I want to hear your stories, which I know you have a lot of. So the first one, just what led you to the work that you do? Like, how did you get to do this work?
Well, I didn't start out doing anything like this, but I was at the UW. I was here for about 6 months, and it was in the summertime, and my phone rang on my desk, and it was my dean saying, "Oh, I'm so glad you're in the office. I've just had an interesting meeting with a woman. Can I send her to you? I'd like you to hear her out and see if there's anything you can do to respond." I said, "Of course." It was my dean, right? And moments later, a stocky little lady came bustling into my office, and she said, "My name is Josephine Archuleta, and I work on homelessness for this church council, which is right up the street. And I've just told your dean all of this, but now I'm going to tell you. All right, the University of Washington is the biggest neighbor in the neighborhood. And when it comes to homelessness, you people aren't even at the table, and you ought to be ashamed." And that was my introduction to homelessness in the U District. Because like a lot of other people, I just sort of, it was in the background. I hadn't really paid a lot of attention. And of course, there were young people on the streets, but you know, that wasn't uncommon. So that conversation led to many more because I asked her who all she had talked to. And she said that everybody else she had talked to had just blown her off. And at least my dean had sent me to somebody else, and that was me. Okay. So I asked her who else she had talked to and what she had asked of them. And it quickly became apparent to me that she was talking to very high-level people at the University of Washington and that she had basically asked to take over their lives. And that wasn't going to go anyplace. So I asked if she could give me their names, if she'd be willing, to let me contact them and to ask them for just a one-hour meeting and they could send a surrogate. They did not have to come. And she said, yes. And I said, "And if we get six people from the university, can you bring five others so that it isn't just one person with this idea, but other people in the community?" Yes. And the very first meeting was at Architecture and Urban Planning in the summer of 1993, and we had indeed six people from the university on one side of a long table and six people from the community on the other side of the table. And as soon as she began talking about the homeless youth in the area, practically everybody on the university side of the table said, "Oh, yeah, it was like that when I was at Berkeley. Oh, yeah, at Columbia, I remember." And people quickly grasped the fact that university areas are like targets for any homeless people who are young. And of course, this area would have something like that. It's a youth-friendly area. You can blend in. Nobody cares if you have six tattoos and 15 pierced body parts. You can sleep in the libraries, for heaven's sakes. Nobody's going to stop you. You can get out of the rain. So that led to what, for a while, we called the Street Kids Meetings. And before long, we became the U District University Partnership for Youth. And I've been hooked on homeless issues in this area ever since.
And so when did you start having some homeless youth themselves or youth that were experiencing homelessness join that effort? Do you have?
Almost immediately. Partly because in the work that I had done in the past that related to poverty and welfare and hunger kinds of issues, I always felt strongly that you needed to have the voice of the people most affected. You don't just have the fancy people with the big degrees deciding what's good for the people who are having a bad time. You get them at the table. It's got to be a two-way street, and they have to be part of making the decisions because otherwise the decisions aren't going to work. So I think that happened very quickly. Oh, also, I started bringing bananas and chocolate to all the meetings.
Right. The chocolate.
And that drew the street kids. They were quite willing to come. And the bananas were my idea because I knew the chocolate would be the draw. But the bananas, you could put those in a backpack. They had their own little carrying case. And they're good for you, right?
Yes.
Yes. And they're filling.
Right.
And to this day, there are people who look at me when I show up for a meeting and say, "But you didn't bring any chocolate."
I brought you chocolate today. I have learned from you, Nancy. You get it after this interview, though.
Okay.
So tell me where you had come from. So you had just moved from Washington, D.C., and what were you doing there?
I worked in and around political Washington for 25-plus years. So I had a couple of stints in what was then the Federal Department of Health, Education, and Welfare. And I was a political appointee in the Carter administration. I was a deputy assistant secretary for legislation that came under the W and the H-E and W. Mm-hmm. My mother, by the way, loved the fact that I had a very long title, and I had to explain to her that in Washington, the really important people have only one word in their title, like president, right. Senator. The minute you start adding all these qualifiers, you're farther down the list. I had also worked in the U.S. Senate for Senator George McGovern. He chaired the Senate Select Committee on Nutrition and Human Needs. So we helped build up the anti-hunger programs and did hunger hearings across the country. And for a time, I worked on the Project on Race and Social Policy. We collectively did a book that sort of brought us up to date from the 1940s when Gunnar Myrdal had done his famous study. And during the Reagan administration, I was director of FRAC, the Food Research Action Center, which still exists. It's a national anti-hunger coalition and organization. It's a terrific advocacy group. And so I was the director during the Reagan years when one of the proposals out of the Reagan administration was to save money in the school lunch program by counting ketchup as a vegetable in the school lunch program.
I remember that.
And we and our network blew the whistle on ketchup and saved brain cells all over America.
There you go. Good job. Yeah. So were you involved in, when you were in Washington, D.C., I mean, obviously around homeless-involved kinds of issues like the hunger ones, but anything that was looking at homelessness in Washington, D.C. at all?
Not particularly. I really was more focused on things like poverty, welfare, hunger.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, homelessness came up in the conversations, but other people were doing that, and I was more focused on the hunger and poverty pieces.
Right, in the national level. So what drew you to Seattle?
Well, in the 80s, for a time, I wrote a self-syndicated op-ed column. and it appeared every Thursday in the Seattle Post-Intelligencer. So I'd gotten to know quite a few people out here. And at one point, I started hearing myself sounding like a jaded old-timer. And I did not want to turn into one of those people in D.C. who was always talking about how we did it in the old days and used to be better when we were doing it and that kind of garbage, right? And I thought, if I don't leave town, I'm going to be one of those people. So by then I had gotten to know quite a few people out here because of the column, and I had been doing commentaries for All Things Considered, and that was another way that I got to know people here. And I had gotten to know the dean of the School of Social Work. I had a social work degree. And one day I called her and asked if there was any chance that they had any openings for somebody like me. And I must admit, I even knew that I was not a typical academic and that this was a long shot. But she paused and said, "It's not that I'm not interested, but I have no open lines." And she did not say, "And of course, you are not a typical academic." She very wisely invited me out as a guest on campus for a semester so that people could get to know me and see whether or not it would be a good fit. Mm-hmm. And then a half-time position opened up. And that, when she suggested that, I asked if it included health coverage. And when she said yes, I was sold on the idea.
You were sold.
Yeah.
And so did you at the time, right, obviously when you moved here, I guess you were getting to know the local politics a little bit more. But how are you thinking about just the whole Seattle, King County area in terms of the culture?
Well, the fact that I had had the column appearing here meant that I would hear from people. And then having that semester when I was really around pretty much full time, that helped a lot. Also, there were other people from D.C. who had already moved out here, so I had been in touch with them, and they were political types like me. We were all political junkies. So I had been having conversations. Sometimes when I would come out this way, we'd all get together for dinner. It was not like foreign territory to me. I had a pretty good sense of what I was getting into. Of course, once you move full time, it always feels different than when you were coming and going and dropping in. But, yeah, it wasn't like I was moving into something completely unknown. And I had known some of the Washington people who were in the Congress, certainly. Senator Magnuson, mm-hmm. Everybody. I knew Maggie's staff. I used to go to meetings in Maggie's office, you know, that kind of stuff. And a lot of the people were very familiar to me. And their aides, goodness, I knew the aides of all the Washington State representatives pretty much. So when I moved out here, that was easy.
You already had those connections.
Yeah, sure.
Right. So what would you say, any people or specific experiences that were the most influential for you over your career in terms of your work around advocacy and especially around homelessness?
Well, I have to admit that I'm an optimist about government and our democratic process. And these days, that puts me in a very small club. But I grew up surrounded by immigrants, and they were passionate about the fact that in this country, we had a voice and we could vote. And by God, we had an obligation to use that right and to be smart about it and pay attention to it. So I guess I have to say that's probably the single biggest influence. And then I worked for wonderful people. Senator McGovern was one of the few PhDs in Congress at the time. He was a leader of the anti-war movement back when America was involved in Vietnam. And he came to that perspective because he had been a bomber pilot in World War II. And seeing what war does to people is what caused him to be anti-war. By the way, one day when I was, I think, in one of the nursing classes here at the UW, a woman came down from the back afterwards and she said, "When they introduced you, they mentioned that you worked in the U.S. Senate. Who did you work for?" And I said, "George McGovern." She said, I used to work there, too. I worked for Bob Dole. Now, young students wouldn't recognize either of those names, but George McGovern was a very liberal Democrat who was the Democratic nominee for president. And some years later, Bob Dole, who was a conservative Republican, was the Republican nominee for president. And the two of them were on the committee. Bob Dole was on our Senate Nutrition Committee at one point. And the two of them would often start off miles apart on an issue. But they respected one another. They would try to find some piece of common ground. They would work away and work away and work away and find more pieces of common ground and more pieces of common ground. And they would come to agreements on things. And then they would go out to dinner with their wives, right? They respected one another. They liked one another. They started from different perspectives, but they did not just name call and brickbat and whatever. So my experience in D.C. was around people like that. And even at the Federal Department of Health, Education, and Welfare, one of the leading lights on senior services was a man named Dr. Fleming. I'm blanking on his first name because everybody knew him as Dr. Fleming, Arthur Fleming. And he was a solid Republican, and he was an appointee of Democrats and Republicans. I think he was probably an Eisenhower appointee once upon a time. But people found ways to respect one another and to find common ground. And I still believe in that, and I still believe that's possible. And I am very, very troubled by low voter turnout and by people who feel that it is not possible to compromise across party lines. So I think that's a slightly different answer. That doesn't really focus on homelessness, but I think it applies to just about any issue. The other thing that I'm very grateful for, not only did I have an opportunity to observe good, thoughtful people, principled people in action in politics, but I saw them work away at it over and over and over again. They didn't just give up. They didn't just name call and say, okay, we didn't get it, goodbye. No, they came back the next year and the next year and the next year. And that was very important. And the third piece is working on poverty-related issues. I was, from the very first, learned from the people around me who'd been there longer than I that you have to include the people who are going to be most affected, that they should be treated with respect, their ideas should be treated with respect, that it is wrong to write people off because they don't happen to have money, because they happen to be going through bad times.
And so how have you seen that going on in terms of more locally, you know, both in the U District and also in Seattle and King County? How would you characterize that?
I don't know that I can speak for all of King County.
Great.
But I have been impressed that the groups that work on hunger, work on homelessness particularly, work on housing, have been very good about always including people who are current or formerly homeless people themselves. And they always have a place at the table, and it is not in a condescending way, a token sort of way. Everybody has a voice at the table. The Washington Low-Income Housing Alliance is a good example. The Seattle-King County Coalition on Homelessness, another good example. Our U District Conversation on Homelessness, another example. None of us think that we do enough of this or are successful enough at it, but we keep plugging away and plugging away. And by the way, one day the mayor, this is now a couple of mayors ago, was having something here in the University District. We were up at U Heights, the former elementary school that's now a community center. And there were different city departments that had their booths out and their tables out, and they were providing information about their different programs and so forth. And as I was walking along, just kind of noticing what was going on, all of a sudden, I recognized somebody across one of these tables. And I couldn't think why this fellow looked so familiar. And then all of a sudden, I thought, oh, Fuzzy! And his head jerked up, and he said, nobody's called me that in years. He was one of the street kids years before. He used to come to our Partnership for Youth meetings. He now works and lives in Bellevue. And I love it when that kind of thing happens and you run into the people who used to be the kids who came to the meetings for the chocolate and stayed for the conversation. And then a few years later, they're running social service programs. They are parents. They tell you about their children.
They're in school.
They're in school.
They're at University of Washington.
They are absolutely at the University of Washington.
Right.
Yes, like one of the young women that I met just a couple of weeks ago. It's just fabulous. One of the projects, we had a conference in 1995 for the Partnership for Youth. And out of that conference came several projects. One of the projects grew out of the fact that the street youth had been telling us that it was hard for them to get a GED if they had dropped out of school for whatever reason and were living on the streets. Nobody took them seriously. They couldn't even get a GED. They didn't even have a chance to get into a community college or take any technical classes or anything to get a job because they couldn't get a GED. So one result of that conference is that we raised some money, hired a teacher, and got it started up the street here. And I'll tell you the name of that in a second. Because I was mentioning this at a meeting recently of a group of University of Washington Health Sciences students who are now embarked on something they call U-District Street Medicine. They are going to do outreach to street people in the U-District and help hook them up with a variety of kinds of health care. And when I finished talking, mentioning that, and there was a little lull, the person sitting next to me, a young student, whispered in my ear, Was that program at the UDYC, the U District Youth Center? And I said, yeah, how did you know? She said, that's where I got my GED. And because she had been able to go to that school and get her GED, which, by the way, is now under the rubric of the Seattle education system, and it has had teachers, our little grant expired long ago, but it's now part of the school system here in Seattle. It was because she got her GED there that she was able to go to community college, and that got her then able to go to the University of Washington, and she's now in the medical school.
So you've been around long enough that you see the fruits of all of that. And tell me a little bit in terms of the 1995 planning program that you were very influential in getting going. What were some of the other health-related projects that came out of that?
Okay. Well, one of the things that people told us, the youth told us, and so did health workers, that there was no kind of interim place for sick youth who were homeless. So if you were not sick enough to be in the hospital, but too sick to be in a shelter where you might pass something on to somebody else, where do you go? And we didn't have an answer when we started. But one result of that conference was the creation of something we called MedRest. And MedRest, we raised some money to be sure that we would have a bed available at one of the youth care facilities. And thanks to people at the University of Washington, yourself included, we were hooked up with a nurse practitioner who we were able to hire on a part-time basis. And then if youth showed up at a shelter needing some kind of medical respite, we had a place for them. And we had a nurse practitioner who would check up on them. And we know we saved at least one life because there was a young man who came in and who, gosh, I'm blanking now on what he had, but it was something that...
It was appendicitis.
Was that it?
Yeah, I think so.
If he had been left in an alley in the rain, he would have been a dead kid.
Right.
But thanks to MedRest, there was a place for him and a nurse practitioner who was checking up on him. And the next thing we knew, you know, he was getting the kind of care he needed. And that happened a number of times. So MedRest was one of the projects that grew out of that.
Right.
Yes. And we also used to work closely with the 45th Street Clinic and some of the other programs around. There's never been enough, and certainly there's never been enough of things like dental care. Or how do you get medications and keep them safe if you're living on the streets? How do you manage some kind of condition that's an ongoing condition? It's real tough if you're a teenager or a young adult and you're living on the streets, you're living under I-5, or you're living in an encampment someplace. So that remains one of the needs, and it's one of the reasons I'm very pleased about these students who are now actively creating U-District Street Medicine. Just stepping back for a moment, our U-District conversation on homelessness includes a fellow who had heard about something like this that was operating in Detroit, Street Medicine Detroit, and it had been started by medical students at Wayne State University. So we arranged to hold one of our meetings via Skype with the students who started that project, and we held that meeting, our side of it, down in the health sciences complex so that the health sciences students would find it easy to come. A number of them did from the different health sciences schools. So we had people from nursing and medicine and dental and pharmacy and public health and social work and, you know, whatever, the rehabilitation programs. And by the end of that meeting, they were saying, we have to do that here. And that has now evolved into U-District Street Medicine. And the students from the health sciences schools who are involved in that are getting affiliation agreements signed by all of their schools, and they are working out all the details and what you'd have to do to make this a reality. And they've started doing outreach, talking to homeless people to find out what are the greatest needs, what kinds of health care can they get now, what can they not easily get now, just real basic stuff. And the students are also getting a better sense of what it means to be a homeless individual in the U District. And by the way, it is not confined just to youth. Among the things that those of us who've been around for a while have noticed is this may have been primarily a homeless youth area in the U District, but by now there are any number of people who regard this as their neighborhood, their home, and they are now middle-aged and aging. And a number of them are veterans. And we have a serious obligation to make sure that we also have services for them and not just youth-oriented things. So we're very conscious of that, and U-District Street Medicine is trying to also be responsible for thinking in terms of all ages, not just teenagers.
Right, and they have an outreach one this evening where they're meeting at the School of Social Work. And
correct.
Going out and doing that, getting it started.
They're trying to go out. They're talking about what they call a soft rollout. Mm-hmm. So they're trying to get out twice a week and going to encampments, going to places where people have set up pitch tents under the freeway, also going to some of the shelters. So they're trying to get a variety of people from a variety of experiences, people who are living in their cars because they can't afford a place to live. I suspect you've noticed, we've all noticed, it's very pricey to live in the U District these days. Mm-hmm.
Anywhere in Seattle area.
Anywhere in Seattle, yes. But, you know, university districts used to have plenty of cheap housing. Boy, it's hard to find these days.
That's true. So what would you say if you think back over your career now? It could be here in Seattle or just your whole career. What would you say, like, as one of them you already mentioned in terms of, like, seeing the fruits of, you know, the seeds of your work that pay off. But what would you say is like, one of your greatest joys in the work that you've done and continue to do?
Oh, well, I guess two things. One, seeing that we can get lots and lots of people engaged in this. It isn't just the do-gooder social work students. It isn't just the church people. It is the business people. It is the homeowners. It is the people from the residence associations. It is the police officers. It is just a whole range of people. And not everybody, obviously, agrees that we should have a focus on homeless people and that we should be putting our energies into low-cost housing. But there are enough of us that I have a lot of hope that we're going to be able to do something bigger than what we've done so far. So I think that would be one thing that I'd hold out. And the other is the amount and variety of services that are now available that were not available when we started. There were always some things, right? But now Our U District Conversation on Homelessness has compiled a little brochure, and it's a brochure that includes information about where to find free meals, food banks, shelters, showers, toilets, drop-in centers, medical assistance, dental care, clean needle distribution, mental health assistance, laundry, clothes, emergency funding, and what to do if you're in a crisis. We could not have compiled anything like this when we started back in 1993, because there were a handful of services. There was teen feed. There was a shelter or two. There was a U District Youth Center. There were drop-in places. But nothing on the scale of what's in place now. And this is the result of lots and lots of people stepping up and saying, yes, housing is a human right. People should not have to live on the streets. We should not be so concerned about judging people. We should be more concerned about housing people. And I think it's paying off.
And probably Josephine Archuleta would be very, very pleased, although she most likely would continue pushing for even more.
Of course. Mind you, she died a few years ago. Right. We were all very sorry about that. But, boy, her legacy, she was a feisty little lady. She was only about 5 feet tall.
I remember her, yes.
Yes.
She had a force.
Oh, gosh, she was a force of nature. Yes. And living proof that one person can make an enormous difference. No question about it.
Right. Yeah. Yes. So, what?
If I could mention one regret.
Well, that's where I was going next, so go for it.
Okay. I think there are many very fine, wonderful individuals at the University of Washington. But I think what Josephine said back in the 1990s remains true. We are the biggest neighbor in the neighborhood, and when it comes to homelessness, we're barely at the table. It is true that these students in health sciences and some of the other programs, there are students in the law school and students in the business school and students all over the place who are concerned and willing to help and will step up. And there are faculty who are wonderful. Institutionally, the University of Washington is still the biggest neighbor in the neighborhood, and it is not even at the table, and we ought to be ashamed. There has been a proposal floating for a couple of years now that we should, on a rotating basis, host Tent City for 4 months, and then the next 4 months at Seattle U and the next 4 months at SPU. Those two other universities in this area have both hosted Tent City. The University of Washington is the only one that hasn't. There are many ways in which we could be helping the street people in the university district. We have facilities, we have toilets, we have showers, we have all kinds of things that would be of help. And as an institution, we don't. And I think we ought to be ashamed. Just like Josephine Archuleta said, we should be ashamed. That needs to change still.
All right. What do you think are some of the biggest barriers?
The notion that somehow it puts us in legal jeopardy. Goodness knows, we already house and shelter and feed and do all kinds of things at the university hospital.
Yes, we do.
We do. And in our sports programs, we put young people at risk in our sports programs all the time. And the lawyers have figured out a way to make it the university safe to do that. I wish I understood the mentality that says that we can do this for all kinds of other people under other circumstances, but we can't do it for the homeless who are living in our backyard. I don't understand it. At one point, I had a bit of a testy conversation with one of the lawyers on campus, and I was trying at the time to get one of the buildings to open up for temporary shelter for 10 youth as an overflow shelter one night a week for the youth shelter up the street, which is called Roots, Rising Out of the Shadows. And the lawyer said, what? You'd have people sleeping in one of our classrooms? I said, they do now. She was not amused. Of course they do now. Goodness. And this, I had even identified 10 mats and all we would have needed is two student volunteers to stay up in four-hour shifts, plus Roots said they would send a youth leader with the 10 youth. And they even said, because the university wasn't accustomed to this, they'd send us the the good youth, the ones that don't make any trouble, right? And all we would need would be one grown-up from the university to be one of the people sleeping in shifts one night a week if there was a need for overflow. You wouldn't even have to if there wasn't any need
for
overflow.
It was mostly winter months for the most part.
Yeah, for the most part. It would have been fall and winter, right? Yeah. And I was told this was impossible. No way it could happen. I think we should be ashamed.
And you've also met with the president, one of the
former presidents
of University of Washington.
Tried
that as well.
Yeah.
So I take it you're not giving up on that one. Yes.
No, of course not.
So besides that, what are some of your hopes for the future in terms of especially this area and dealing with homelessness and people in poverty?
Well, I have one very practical one. You know, the U District is undergoing some massive changes because we're going to have the transit come through here and we're going to have light rail come through here and all kinds of things are happening. And so there's an enormous amount of building. And I have had a so far losing battle, but I'll mention.
So far.
So far. I think we should do what has been done in some other communities when they've suddenly had a new rail system or a new bus system or a new transit system go in. They have required that at least some of the buildings must set aside some space, and it doesn't have to be much, for low-cost rent where you can locate social services near the transit. So right now, all of our child care in this area has waiting lists. But we are hoping to attract families, working families. Children's Hospital is building, and they are building space for 3- and 4-bedroom places, which means they're expecting people to come with families. We have all kinds of housing going up. We have offices going up. There are people who are going to need child care near their workplace. But child care cannot operate in high rent space. It simply can't. That's why you find it in places like old schools and old church buildings and that sort of thing. Similarly, if we want to keep and attract the senior citizens, people who love this area, who are UW retirees, for heaven's sakes, we need to have senior services. And we need to respect the fact that lots of families have a member with a disability of one kind or another. That means we need to have services for them. And we have many immigrant students who come to the University of Washington. We're grateful for them. We're glad to have them. But sometimes they need services. And that needs affordable space. And the big old church buildings can no longer afford or handle all of the needs. So we should have some kind of either incentive zoning or some set aside or something. It doesn't mean that you can't make a profit on the building, but we ought to have near the transit centers and near the stations some way for working people and families and people of all ages to be able to get to and from doctor's appointments, medical appointments, dental appointments, I don't care what kind of appointments, but also just basic social services. That's part of what it means to have a community. And it would mean also that our homeless population could be served by those services. We have families living in cars with young children. That is appalling. And they can't afford child care in this area. And if the parents want to try to get a job, they have to go looking for the job. They have to use transit. Where are the kids going to go? It seems to me it's so basic. So far I have not won that battle.
And who are you working with?
Well, I go to all the community meetings. This has been my song and dance for a very long time. And ever since the conversation started several years ago and the city people, you know, reached out to people like me and said, we're interested in your input, I told them about one of the stations on the BART line down in Northern California, the Fruitvale station, where community groups got together and insisted on exactly that. And it's a thriving community, and the businesses are doing very well. But they have space built in for senior housing, for social services, for child care, for disability services, for all kinds of stuff. We could be doing the same, and it is criminal that we are not. That's in my humble opinion.
So how do you keep from burning out, Nancy? I mean, one thing that strikes me in the years I've known you is just your energy, your enthusiasm, your glass is half full kind of a thing. But how do you do it? How do you keep going?
I think I inherited my mother's Pollyanna genes. I don't think I get any credit for it. It just came with the territory.
So can you tell me a little bit more about that?
I don't even understand it.
Well, like give me an example of your mom. How did she exhibit that?
Oh, gosh. Well, among other things, first of all, my dad was an immigrant. He grew up in Italy. He had to drop out of school at the age of 8 because World War I broke out, and his dad was sucked up into the Italian army. So my dad and his brothers had to drop out of school and help their mom. Yeah, they were basically tenant farmers, very poor, but, you know, somebody had to look after the chickens and the goats and the cows and stuff. And so the boys dropped out of school to help their mom do that. When he came to the United States, he came as a young man. He turned 18 on the boat. And he was relentlessly upbeat about the opportunities that prevailed in this country. My mother wasn't raised overseas, but she grew up in a little community that was a coal mining town, shallow coal mines in Illinois. And her dad and mother were Italian immigrants. And when she was in eighth grade, when she was about to graduate from eighth grade, she wanted to go to secretarial school. And the teachers at the school told her that she had no business thinking like that. That was above her station, that secretaries needed to wear fancy clothes, and she should instead go to work and contribute to her family because her family needed her money. That she had no business thinking that she should be, you know, sitting behind a desk wearing a dress. So she went to work for a dry cleaner, learned how to operate a mangle, pressed pants hour after hour for the dry cleaner. And when I would ask her, but didn't that make you mad? She'd say, no, they were right. I had a job and I was contributing to my family. And I was able to help my sisters because they were younger and they couldn't contribute to the family. Talk about Pollyanna. That was my mom. And the other thing that intrigues me, and I wish I had thought to ask when my parents were still alive, but of course I didn't. How is it that they sent their daughters to college at a time when most women didn't go to college, when none of the relatives had been anywhere near college except to work on the, you know, work as the gardeners and the maids and the stuff like that? My parents were domestics, and most of the relatives had very menial kinds of jobs, and yet my oldest sister went to college, and then the next sister went to college. And by that time, of course, it was a custom. Of course, I would go to college, right? And we had to get good grades because otherwise we wouldn't get scholarships. And we had to work in the summertime, and we had to work after school because otherwise we couldn't afford it because my parents couldn't pay for tuition. We had to pay our way, right? And through it all, they were just relentlessly upbeat, except that when I finally did ask a couple of the relatives if they had any idea where this came from, one of my cousins said, well, you know, it was the men in the family who said that the girls should go to college. The women thought it would make them unmarriageable.
Interesting.
But anyway, so I grew up around people who had every reason to be gloomy and down and whiny and complaining and everything. They worked backbreaking jobs, long hours. Sometimes my mother would come home. She frequently earned a little money by serving as a waitress in private homes. And she would sometimes come home late at night and she'd say, I'm never going back to that place again. They treat me like dirt under their feet. They treat us, you know, those of us in the kitchen, they treat us like we're not even human beings. But of course, when they would call, she'd go back, mm-hmm. right? Because we needed the money. And she would stay upbeat. So, yeah, I don't have any choice.
So you inherited it from
me. I inherited it. I don't get any credit for it at all. It's genetic.
But I imagine it takes some nurturing on your part.
Maybe.
So how do you nurture that?
I don't know.
Have you thought about that?
No. Sorry. I can't. Just blame my mom.
Right.
And my dad.
Yeah.
Relentlessly upbeat. Yes.
So, but how do you take care of yourself?
I walk a lot.
Okay.
I eat well. Chocolate.
Yes. And occasional bananas.
Yes. Right. Absolutely. I work in my garden. And I hang out around students. I am now, as I put it, semi-retired. But I'm involved with the students who are doing the U District Street Medicine. I go to their meetings. And with a group that calls itself HEC, the Health Equity Circle, they're fabulous. And I go to the monthly meetings of the Health Sciences Service Learning and Advocacy Group. And being around those students just keeps me, wound up, I guess. They are just fabulous. And they are impatient. And they think that we're taking much too long to do any of these things. And I think that's wonderful. And that gets my juices flowing.
Right. So that sense of hope and enthusiasm from the students.
Oh, yeah. The other thing, I'm old enough to be able to say that when I graduated from college, there was no Medicare. There was no Medicaid. There was no Head Start. There was no WIC program. Food stamps was a pilot demonstration project in 7 counties. What else? Oh, school lunch was only in the schools that could afford it, only in the rich schools. There was no senior nutrition program. There was no Americans with Disabilities Act. There was no Civil Rights Act. There was no Voting Rights Act. What else? Oh, there were no women in professional sports because there was no Title IX. So I think all of those things passed within maybe 20 years from when I graduated. Well, if you have lived through that kind of change and you've seen it happen, and most of that is stuff that helps people who are not rich, who are not powerful. Food stamp recipients are not rich and powerful. Welfare moms are not rich and powerful. We can do things in this country, and you don't have to be rich and powerful to make it happen. But you do have to vote, and you do have to pay attention to who's in office. You do have to pay attention to the candidates, and you do have to speak up.
And care, right?
And care. Yeah. You don't have to be an expert. You just have to care, and you have to be willing to get involved a little bit. By the way, the first bill that made it all the way through the process last year and was signed into law by our governor was the Washington Dream Act. And that helps immigrant kids who aren't even voters, for heaven's sakes, who were brought here as children by their immigrant parents and who needed to get a fair deal in order to get into college and be able to afford it. Now, that is not a group that was greasing any palms or writing big campaign checks. And this year, two of the bills that passed are bills that help foster kids and homeless youth. And again, that's not a wealthy, powerful group. So one of the things I want to do and I work on is trying to get the big money out of politics. I think that's corrupting our system. But I want to make sure that people continue to know that they have a voice, and when they use their voice, they can make a difference, and they don't have to be rich and powerful in order to do that.
So
that's what I spend my time on.
Right, and that brings me to butter.
Ah!
Please.
You want the butter story?
I want the butter story.
Okay.
Are you okay? You want to take a break?
No, okay. I'm fine. If you're willing to hear the butter story again.
I have to hear the butter story.
Before I tell it, I will tell you that not long ago, somebody walked up to me and said, "There's no way you would know who I am. I was just in an audience once, but I have two words to say to you. Butter, butter."
Yes, it's something that sticks
memorable.
Around.
It's memorable. Okay, I did not make this up. This is a political classic. Once upon a time, there was a fellow who was newly elected to the United States Congress. And after his election, it kind of went to his head. He got a little vain about it. So the first time he was invited to a fancy dinner, he showed up early. He thought, everybody will come early just to see me. Well, of course, nobody did. So here he is in a big fancy hotel banquet hall, and he's the only one there except for the waitress. And the waitress is doing her job. This is a fancy dinner, so you're not going to have to share anything. In fact, she was at that point going around putting butter on the individual butter plates. And she was going methodically around the room, and every time she saw one little plate, she put one pat of butter. One plate got one pat of butter. One plate, one pat of butter. Finally, she got to him, and he said, excuse me, I really like butter. Think I could, you know, have another pat of butter? She looked at him and said, sorry, sir. We treat everyone the same. One plate gets one pat of butter. She went right on to the next table. He thought about that for a minute. He was pissed. There was nobody in the place, so he got up and he followed her. She's now at this other table, right? He said, excuse me, maybe you don't know who I am. I'm a United States senator. She said, maybe you don't know who I am. I'm the one that gives out the butter. Now, I tell that story to people because votes are like butter, and we are the ones that give out the butter. We have something that every candidate and every elected official from school board right up to president of the United States wants. They want our butter. And when you put out your hand and you shake the hand of a candidate or somebody who's in office and you say, hi, I'm Nancy and I live in your district, little voice in the back of their brain says, butter. And if you say, and I'm part of the U District Conversation on Homelessness, and we have about 300 people on our mailing list, our email list, butter, butter. And we are part of the much larger statewide Washington State Coalition Alliance. Oh, gosh. I'm going to get killed for bungling that. Okay. The Washington Low Income Housing Alliance, which has thousands of members all across the state who are active and who care about ending homelessness, they hear, that's a cholesterol hit. That's a heart attack in the making. And that's what we can do with our votes. Butter. That's all it takes. Butter, butter.
Butter, butter.
Butter, butter.
Yes. And I know you run into people all the time that remember that story, as well as you and I ran into one of your former students on the steps down in Olympia. Do you remember that? And she had the folder already.
Well, because I tell people that it's easy. You may feel shy when you're starting out, but you can advertise your issue very simply. Among other things, you can wear a pin or a T-shirt that's got a message on it. I'm wearing a pin right now, and it has the number 32,494. Mm. That's the number of homeless children in our Washington State schools. And frequently, people in a grocery store line or something will say, what's that number about? And I get a little chance to be an advocate on behalf of homeless kids in our Washington State schools, right? Okay. So you can do that. But the other thing you can do, if you're going to go to the city council or you're going to the county council or you're going down to Olympia or something, you can get a cheap little folder at the dime store and you can download the fact sheets from whatever advocacy group you're part of. If you're on an email list for an advocacy group like Washington Low Income Housing Alliance or Seattle King County Coalition on Homelessness or Children's Alliance or any number of groups, you put those fact sheets there. So you bring them along so that you can give them out to your elected officials and to other people. And on the back, you write in bold letters, in just one or two words, what you care about, like fund housing or end homelessness. And then everywhere you go, you clutch your folder to your chest with those words flashing out at everybody that you pass. Nobody can miss the point. Nobody can miss why you're there. They'll see that you care about homelessness. You're advertising your issue everywhere you go. And frequently people will ask you about that. And you say, oh, yes, and I just happen to have a fact sheet. And you can hand it out. And you can put your name on the bottom of it if you want to give that and your contact information over to your elected officials. It's cheap, low cost, easy. Anybody can do it.
Right.
Yeah. It's one of.
So we saw in action that some of your former students were doing that without your prompting. Yes. Well, maybe with your initial prompting, but well, they remembered it.
Yes, and it's easy to remember. And, you know, it doesn't take a lot of time. The other day, I did a session with a group that's called the Emerging Advocates Program. And these are homeless and formerly homeless people who are learning to be spokespeople for other people like themselves. And this is a project of Real Change, our street newspaper, mm-hmm. and the Washington Low Income Housing Alliance. And so a number of them have definitely learned that message. But I also decided that I was going to give them another similar message. So I had a shirt on that was buttoned right up to my neck. And at one point when I was talking about how you can advertise your issue in a variety of ways with a pin, with a folder, with whatever, I said, does anybody know the music for a striptease? And as people started going, dum da dum, dum da dum, dum da dum, I started unbuttoning this shirt. And underneath I had a T-shirt, which I flashed open, that said, healthcare is a right, not a privilege. And they cracked up.
There you go. Nancy stripping. That's the first time I've heard that one.
Yeah. Okay, it wasn't exactly a striptease. I was just taking one layer off to reveal another layer. But yeah, I mean, we all have T-shirts, right? Easy. And instead of advertising, I don't know, Amazon, you can advertise healthcare for homeless people. You can advertise housing now. You can advertise just about anything. And sometimes people will ask you about it. Well, as it turns out, I was still wearing that T-shirt afterwards when I stopped at the grocery store. And I was on 45th Street, right across from the QFC over in Wallingford. And a woman noticed my T-shirt that said, healthcare is a right, not a privilege. And she said, I love what your T-shirt says. That's exactly right. And so we got into a great little conversation, talked about why we both agreed about this, and we both high-fived before we took off opposite ways across the street.
Nice.
Yeah, it's great. Easy.
So anything else that I haven't asked you that you would like to talk about a little bit that's related to homelessness, especially in our county, in our area?
Well, just that I am always conscious of not only the people who do show up, but the numbers who don't. And I am conscious of...
Are you talking about political events of some sort? Is that what
you're
talking about?
And also community events. When there's any kind of planning meeting here in the university district, you don't see a whole lot of people showing up, even though they're widely advertised and they say we want input from the community. There aren't a whole lot of people who show up unless they are part of an organized group and they are there to represent their group. But we don't see a lot of, quote, ordinary citizens showing up at stuff. And we certainly don't see an awful lot showing up at city council or county council or state legislature unless a group has really hustled to get them out. But by the way, a couple of years ago, I brought one of our Cambodian students up to the city council because I had been talking about it and I wanted him to see it firsthand. And as you probably know, our city council sets aside 10, 15, sometimes 20 minutes at the beginning of every full council session, so people who are there who want to comment on something can get 2 minutes in front of the mic. You just sign in and you're called up in the order in which you signed in. And if there are too many people, they ask you to keep your comments to a minute or a minute and a half. But everybody gets a chance to say something. And during the course of this little open mic period, some of the people who stepped up to the mic were angry at the council members and said so and yelled at them. And one fellow pointed his finger at them and said he thought they were stupid and how could you be so dumb and don't you understand and that sort of stuff. And he was clearly angry. But he was not alone. Most people were polite, but some couple weren't. As we were walking out, the Cambodian student said, those people who signed up at the beginning, did they sign their real name? Yes, I said. But they were angry at the council. Yes. Weren't they afraid? No. Aren't they afraid someone will come after them? No. They weren't afraid for their families? No. No one will go after their family.
they can say those things and no one will come after them, right? That's part of our system. Well, you know, I live this stuff, but being with that Cambodian student was just such a good reminder, even for me, that it's so easy to take this for granted and not appreciate the right we have to speak up. We can testify in Olympia. We can testify at a city council meeting, a county council meeting. Before the budgets are settled, there's always open mic nights. Anybody can show up, and no one will come after us. So I think we just have to remind ourselves of the privilege we have. Do something with it on behalf of, in this case, people who are homeless. No one should have to be homeless in our wealthy society. No one should have to be hungry. We shouldn't have people going without health care. Those are just basics. I may regret saying this, but as I've listened to the debate unfolding in Olympia over the budget, I find myself reminded repeatedly that it is now common knowledge that our state has the most unfair tax system in the United States. There was a period when only a handful of people knew it, and people who follow budgets and analyze budgets would say it, and Citizens for Tax Justice and the Washington State Budget and Policy Center and the Economic Opportunity Institute, they all said it, but it wasn't common knowledge. These days, it's even in the Seattle Times, and that's not exactly a liberal rag, right? People repeat it. It gets mentioned all the time. And yet we have members of our legislature insisting that they cannot possibly come up with any revenues, new revenues, for low-cost housing, for mental health, people who are mentally ill, who are being warehoused in our jails and sometimes in our emergency rooms, that they cannot make college affordable for our students who are now piling up thousands of dollars in debt because we have legislators who insist they can't come up with any more money for higher education, who insist that the only way that they can meet the McCleary decision that the Supreme Court handed down to fully fund K through 12 is basically by cutting back on other things and making little tiny, tiny changes, by taking the money away from marijuana sales that is supposed to be going through drug and alcohol treatment and education and to medical kinds of services. They now are going to try to use that. Some of them want to use that to meet the McCleary decision. It seems to me that what they are saying is we place a higher value on protecting the unfairness in our tax system than we do on making our state a livable state for our people. We put a higher value on protecting the unfairness in our tax system than on our college students who have to pile up thousands of dollars in debt, or our medical students or nursing students who have to pile up additional debt on top of that to get a health sciences degree. That we care more about protecting and saving the unfairness in our tax system than in raising the revenues that would come in if we made it a little bit fairer, which we could then use to help mentally ill people, to make sure that we are not throwing people in jail when they should have been given some kind of care. It's a mentality I don't understand. And yeah, I just don't understand it. When people say we have to live within our means, well, these are the means that we get by having an unfair tax system. We could have bigger means to live within if we had a fairer tax system.
More equitable.
Yeah.
Right.
Yep. But until then, we'll keep plugging away at it.
We'll keep working
on it. And we'll keep working on trying to make sure that homeless people in the university district get treated fairly by all of our U District community.
All right.
How about that?
That sounds perfect. Anything else you wanted to say, or you feel like that's it? I wanted to thank you for your time.
You're welcome.
It's been wonderful.
My pleasure.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you for letting me tell the butter story.
Yes, we had to do the butter story. All right. That's it.